So it's been a while since I last talked, and it was year before last. And I talked last time about gratitude practice. So that fits in with the guidance of the meditation. And I talked about how gratitude can be known in the body and how it can be a very pleasant and even a sublime experience. I also talked back then about how, for me, it's such a strong basis for metta practice. And it's also a great way to cultivate a friendly attitude towards one's experience, whatever it might be. And I think of gratitude and generosity as being very closely linked. Gratitude just leads very naturally to a generous state of mind. Generosity is a way to let go, to counter greed, including spiritual greed, and I'll talk more about that. So I'm talking tonight about generosity. Generosity is the first of the 10 paramis or the 10 perfections. And by the way, the Buddha did love his numbered lists. We have the Four Noble Truths, the seven Awakening Factors, the Five Hindrances, many, many others. There's a whole book in the Sutta Pitaka of just numbered lists. It's a list of lists. My sister calls this numerical Buddhism. She's fed up with it, but I still find it entertaining. And it's a great mnemonic device for when you're conveying this, especially as the Buddha and his followers did for so long through oral transmission. But the Buddha had all these lists. He never actually did mention 10 paramis. And there are different numbers of paramis in different lineages. I think there are six in Vajrayana Buddhism, for instance. But he did talk about all of the qualities, all of the perfections. And when the Buddha met newcomers, when he came to a town where they were unfamiliar with him, or when he talked to a group of householders or Brahmins or Jains or government officials or whoever, he would start by talking about generosity. And then he would move to ethics, the sila. And only then would he move on to the Four Noble Truths and the other teachings that we see as being core to what we call Buddhism now. So, and why generosity? Well, of course, back then there was a symbiosis between the lay community and the monastics, and this predated the Buddha. And it certainly wasn't exclusive to the Buddha and his followers. There were a number of mendicant groups at this time in India. And they relied on the generosity of the villages and the towns and the people there. And there was a strong cultural support. People, even today in Burma, vie to show their generosity to the monastics. There's almost a competitive dana practice there. So the symbiosis between lay people and monastics is about the monastic. There was very much an attitude at the time that these monastics were pursuing knowledge. The attitude towards them was a lot like attitude of our American public towards astronauts in the 1960s. They were exploring outer space. People in northern India knew that these monastics were exploring inner space. And doing so on their behalf, learning about the universe. So we continue this today, and you've heard about this, and I want to make sure that this doesn't just devolve into nagging everyone here about dana. But I do need to touch on it because dana is the Pali word that's usually translated as generosity. So you've heard us talk about generosity a lot. So I want to talk about generosity as a practice specifically. Many people think of generosity as being being like a transaction or as an expected behavior. But when we do that, we're missing out on a potentially beautiful experience. The world of samsara is all about greed, about getting things. We feel frustrated when we fail to get, and we're disappointed when we do get. This whole thing about greed is wrapped up in dukkha. It's a part of dukkha. I mean, it's the flip side, of course, of aversion and hatred and pushing away. So we're really focusing on just one side of a coin here when we talk about greed. So giving is letting go. It's an antidote to greed. So I have a problem with spiritual greed. And practice is about letting go, as I said. It's not about getting things. When you try to get stuff when you meditate, you run into a wall. And, you know, I got this. Practice is letting go, not about getting things. I got this intellectually when I first heard it. I thought, oh, yeah, sure. That's obvious. What a wonderful truth to know. But I realize that still, even now, I have not internalized it. I don't have this on a visceral level. I did a home retreat recently. Barbara went on a retreat for various reasons. I did not go, so I had plenty of time around the house, did some chores, but I also did a home retreat. And I found that it was very quiet. I was able to get some mental stability and even some deep states of concentration fairly quickly. But I wanted more. I wanted deeper states of consciousness. I wanted big time insights. I found myself going, I want serenity, damn it. Where is it? I was deep in greed, the spiritual greed. You know, I know that on the meditation level, if you try to sit down and achieve something, you get stuck in greed and self-judgment for having the greed, and you just sort of go in circles. There's a lot of suffering there. Meditation, again, is about letting go of stuff, not about getting stuff. We forget that. We want to get something out of meditation. We want to get serenity. We want to fix ourselves. This comes up a lot. We want to fix a problem. We've got some problem. Oh, I'll be mindful. I gave a whole talk on how we use mindfulness as something in our toolbox, like aspirin in the medicine chest, and how often we get caught up in using mindfulness rather than enjoying mindfulness. So we start to see mindfulness as something that we use to fix things, like duct tape or WD-40. And so we don't find ourselves or even think of allowing ourselves to be mindful of pleasant things, of nice things, of generosity and how that feels in the body. So this is why greed and desire are one of the five hindrances. And most of you know what they are. I'll list them anyway. There's greed. But the flip side of greed is aversion and hatred. Then there is agitation and sloth and torpor. I love that. That's such a Victorian sounding translation. And then the fifth of the hindrances is doubt, sometimes called the mother of all hindrances. They usually show up, by the way, more than one at a time. So one teacher said that if someone doesn't understand the value of simple generosity, then they're not even teachable, which I think is a fairly extreme statement. I don't know. I don't think I agree with that. But generosity is, after all, the basis for sila, for ethics, and for metta, for loving kindness. I mean, really, ethics is a form of generosity. You're trying to take care of other people in the same way that you wish to be taken care of. This is a form of giving, helping to give other people the kind of world that you wish to live in yourself. So sometimes our generosity is mixed. We might be giving because we're complying with standards and customs, which isn't, it's not really a generosity practice. It's not entirely a bad thing either. Giving as a way of complying with standards, with the local customs is at least you're giving and not taking. Sometimes we can end up giving as a form of passive aggression. Oh, here, just take it. I don't really need it. I didn't want that anyway. Just take it. Or we end up giving as a way of insulting or diminishing someone, like giving somebody a cookbook as a subtle way of criticizing their cooking. Sometimes we give as a way of asserting ourselves. That's what mansplaining is all about. Here, let me tell you how that works. This mansplaining thing, I'll explain mansplaining to you. Just sit back and listen. Or we give in a transactional way, like returning a favor. And in the Buddha's teachings, giving is encouraged as a way to ensure a better rebirth. And this also has a transactional quality, sort of a profit and loss mentality. And I'll get back to this. This stuff isn't all bad, but I wanted to go to the suttas a little bit because, what's a Dharma talk without some suttas? So generosity has some qualities that I like to think of as near enemies, which is to borrow a notion from the Visuddhimagga, and the way the Visuddhimagga treats the Brahmaviharas. And that's a whole nother talk, which I have given. You can look it up on the website. So here from the Anguttara Nikaya, it's Anguttara Nikaya 8.31, if you'd like to look it up. There are, O monks, eight ways of giving. What eight? One gives spontaneously, or one gives out of fear, or because of thinking he too has given me a gift, or because of thinking he will give me a gift. Two, or because of thinking that it is a good idea to give, or because of thinking I cook, but they, being ascetics, do not. Since I cook, it would not be proper for me to refuse giving a meal to those who do not cook. It's fairly elaborate. Number seven is, or because of thinking by giving such a gift, I shall earn a good reputation. Or one gives because it ennobles the mind. Adorns the mind. It's kind of interesting image, sort of like the mind is a Christmas tree, being adorned by ornaments. So there's a collection of motives there, and many of them are transactional in nature. Here's another one, also from the Anguttara Nikaya 8.33. There are, O monks, eight ways of giving. What eight? This is a different eight, by the way. I'm not going to do the same list again. He didn't. Eight ways of giving. What eight? People may give out of affection, or in an angry mood, or out of stupidity, or out of fear, or because of thinking such gifts have been given before by my father and grandfather, and it was done by them before. Hence, it would be unworthy of me to give up this old family tradition. Or because of thinking, by giving this gift, I shall be reborn in a good destination in a heavenly world after death. Or because of thinking, when giving this gift, my heart will be glad and happiness and joy will arise in me. Or one gives because it ennobles and adorns the mind. So I want to say these transactional forms of generosity are not necessarily bad. We're social animals, and these behaviors are part of the glue that hold us together. Reciprocity is an important behavior in social beings. So I don't want to be dismissive of them. And the thing about being generous because you'll have a better rebirth. This ties into the whole notion that appears in most major religions that you should be ethical and be a good person and be generous because you'll go to heaven, avoid hell, have a better rebirth, whatever. And that's an unfortunate kind of transactional thinking, I think. And it's inevitable that it arises. It's certainly arisen in most major religions and spiritual practices. But I like to think of Pascal's wager. Pascal's wager is if there is a hell and a heaven, and I'm a good person and act ethically, then I'll be rewarded. I will go to heaven and avoid hell. If there is no heaven and no hell, and I'm a good person, I will still be happy. So it's worthwhile my being an ethical person, whether there's a hell or a heaven or not. This shows up in Buddhism, by the way. There's at least two suttas where the Buddha treats this kind of argument, and he approves it. You can just substitute better rebirth or worse rebirth for the heaven and hell. But it's the same notion shows up in the Buddhist teachings. One of those suttas, by the way, is called the Safe Bet Sutta. So it uses the same wagering analogy as Pascal's wager. So how do we practice generosity? And the answer is fairly simple, I think. It's just to observe our motives and learn from the experience. How does it feel? How does generosity feel in the body? I've encouraged people, because I've found it very helpful for myself, to feel gratitude in the body as a physical sensation, because then, it's palpably pleasurable in the body. Gratitude is, and generosity can be as well. I'd like to point out that there are a number of forms of generosity. Dana is an obvious one. The dana as money is an obvious one. But in the ancient communities, in the symbiosis between the lay and the monastic communities, food was equally important, even more so, especially because many of these were pre-cash economies. And there's service. How can you help? Sometimes generosity is very small, like letting a bicyclist go through an intersection even when it's your turn. Momentum is important to cyclists, and you just gave someone the gift of momentum. Being a good listener is a powerful form of generosity. We often don't appreciate it in ourselves, especially because sometimes being a good listener can be kind of tiresome. Sometimes you have to consciously note that you've been generous and pat yourself on the back for it. Smiling at a stranger is an act of generosity. A story that I've told here before is of a young man who wrote a note in his apartment, and the note said, "I'm going to walk to the Golden Gate Bridge, and if anybody smiles at me, I will come back to my apartment." He walked to the Golden Gate Bridge, and he jumped off, and the note was found. You never know what a smile, a simple smile, can do to improve somebody's day. Or even potentially save a life. So why would we want to practice generosity besides the potential pleasure in it. Generosity is a way to lessen our selfishness. Selfishness leads to discontent, which is often noticed. There's all that stuff we want. The television encourages us to be selfish. It keeps telling us all the things that we want, that we should be going out and buying, and that we are going to be unhappy unless we acquire them. So selfishness is a hook. It's a bait. It's a trap. Selflessness leads to the end of greed, hatred, and delusion. Selflessness is a great practice itself. This is anatta. This is anatta as an action rather than an assertion about the truth of the universe or who we are. This is anatta as a practice rather than a statement of faith. So here's another one from the Anguttara Nikaya. I've leaned on it heavily tonight. It's 3.6.37. In this world, monks, there are three good things for one who gives. What are these three things? Before giving, the mind of the giver is happy. While giving, the mind of the giver is made peaceful. After having given, the mind of the giver is uplifted. So that's really all I have. So we have loads of time for questions, comments, observations, jokes, rants. Anybody? You've lapsed into... Oh, Corey.
Thanks, Bill. As always, I really enjoy your talks. It's interesting that they had two lists of eight different ways. One, I noticed an overlap, but I'm curious, did you have more commentary, though, on these different eight and which ones were more wholesome than others or which ones led to more liberation than others or anything like that?
I didn't find it, and I did not dig deeper than that. I think there's always an implication. Well, there's one in particular who says people may give out of being in an angry mood or out of stupidity. I'm not sure what that even means. I was reading one of those big volumes where the footnotes don't really go into much detail here. So I think we sort of have to read it on the surface, unless we want to dig into, are there references in other people's works or Dharma books? Don't know. So my take at first was a lot of these things are sort of like business deals. Or because of thinking, say, I will give because he too has given me a gift, sort of returning the favor. And then I thought, oh, okay, well, that's maybe not very powerful as a spiritual practice. But on the other hand, it's important. A friend invites us over for dinner. We go there. We have a good time. Sometime in the foreseeable future, we should invite them over for dinner. This is part of sort of how social relations work, that we're all sort of interrelated, and this is a way that we can have some social glue. So sorry, I don't have anything more broader or more specific than that.
I suppose it's a pasika, right?
Right. See for yourself. What does the practice feel like to you? So Sherry and or Bowman.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Today earlier today we joined Sunday Sangha live, and we saw Liz there. Great to see you again, Liz. So we had done it because Lisa Ernst, a teacher that we're familiar with, who has been here, was going to be teaching there. And so we wanted to support her. So it was a way of giving. And she talked in the beginning of it about generosity or dana. And she connected it with a sense of interconnection, is that when we are generous, that we cultivate interconnection between the giver and the receiver, and that it creates an intimacy in that interconnection. I thought that was a really good way of explaining one of the benefits of dana or generosity.
Yeah, I like that. Cherie, did you want to add something?
Well, yeah, totally different than what Bowman's saying, but what was coming up for me when you were reading that list is Christmas time is the time of giving, right? But when we're little kids, and like I remember having this Sears catalog and the magic marker on every page, want, 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 you know? And it's really kind of a good way to, you know, there like all those reasons come up at that time of year. You know, oh, I want to give something to the mailman, and why, and what about the teacher at school, and this one, and trying to teach the children about, you know, the real meaning of giving, and so I really like that. I really like that list. It's a good litmus test to see, you know, what the real motive is behind it. And I think that's going to be equal to what you, you know, get out of it. So yesterday, a little girl up the street came to the door and knocked on the door and said, it was her and her little friend, and they were charging $6 to walk the dogs around the whole neighborhood, or they'd walk your dog halfway through the neighborhood for $3. So, of course, they got $6 for walking her dog, and it felt wonderful to do this little thing for these kids who were, you know, it was really great. So it was an interconnection because of generosity.
Thanks. Yes, which ties into what Bowman said, that that this helps remind us that we're in this web of interdependence. That which goes back to the whole synergy between the monastic and lay communities in ancient India. So, yes, I think that's a different way of emphasizing that interdependence. And I think Christmas is one of those things that you could do a whole Dharma talk on the complexities of Christmas. About 8 or 10 years ago, I and my brothers and sisters who are, you know, in my rough age cohort gave each other the gift of not having to give each other gifts anymore, because we all agreed that it was such a source of stress figuring out what to give to people. You know, what did they already have? What did they not have? And we all had way too much stuff already. So that was a great gift, just letting each other off the hook, that, you know, saying, you know, we still have to give gifts to the, you know, 8-year-olds and the 6-year-olds, because it's too hard to explain. And, you know, they like stuff. So, you know, there's still that kind of reciprocity thing. But yes, Christmas is really complicated.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you. Patty? Patty, you're muted.
Yeah, it's a new computer for me. I was trying to unmute.
Oh.
Thank you, Bill. That was wonderful. I have a few comments. First, I'm glad someone brought up Christmas, because when I heard the list, I thought about weddings and the calculation that goes into a wedding gift. What did they give you for your wedding? And what did your cousin give to the other cousin at their wedding? I thought that was really interesting. But also what came up for me was I love the idea that generosity and gratitude go hand in hand. Because a few years ago, Tara Brach told the story about a monk who gave the same mantra to, a monastic, a woman, who gave the same mantra to everybody who came to see her. And the mantra, and I've been using it since then, the mantra is, Thank you for everything. I have no complaints whatsoever. And it's a really wonderful mantra, because whether or not it's true when you start saying it, it becomes true the more you keep saying it. And I say that almost every night before I go to sleep, over and over again. And I find it really calming and joy producing. It makes me realize how much I do have to be grateful for. And it helps me be generous, because it makes me realize there's abundance everywhere. Even if it's not material abundance, there's abundant love, there's abundant kindness, there's abundant generosity all around me. And when I can cultivate gratitude for that, it's much easier to share it and give it out. So thank you for that talk. It was inspiring.
Well, thank you. And yes, I hadn't even thought about weddings, but yes, there's definitely a very strong social component. There are cultures where the bride dances around in a dress and people pin currency to the dress. This is fairly common in other cultures. You don't see that in the U.S. that much. But yes, weddings are, again, are even, in a way, even more complicated than Christmas. But yeah, I think, and I said so earlier in the talk, and I'm glad that you reinforced this, that when the gratitude is strong, the generosity feels very natural, and the generosity doesn't have to be around money or around food or any objects. The generosity can be something much more about presence, even. Presence, not presence as in gifts, but presence as in being there. So thank you. Barbara.
I don't have a whole lot to say, but I just thought about this, the reason why they have all these lists of motives. And Sherry brought that up too, about the idea of purifying your motives and training the mind to be generous. And sometimes just doing it can create more generosity, especially if, again, you can be mindful and be aware when it's not entirely pure, your motive, but just that gradual purification, I think, can happen by actually practicing generosity.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, that when you start to cultivate it, you might find yourself sort of walking somewhere and saying, oh, so-and-so would really like that. Or, I know that so-and-so would really like that joke. I got to remember it and tell it to her. Isabel.
Yeah, hi. That was a great talk.
Thank you.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, yes. There's a little bit of an echo, but we can make sense of it.
Okay. Because I have two screens going. That's why. Let me turn the other one off.
Oh, it's okay. You're fine.
I really liked your talk. And I think that I have a gratitude practice. And I think that that there's a sense of abundance that comes out of a gratitude practice that's really related to generosity in a kind of first cousin kind of way. And then there's also a relationship to contentment, since we were talking about contentment earlier on, that sense of enoughness is really present in gratitude. And then it's part of generosity, and they're all kind of interrelated. And when you're cultivating a good sense of a gratitude, then you end up feeling content and spreading that around, like you say. And there's also, I think, a relationship between, like someone else mentioned, metta. Metta for sure is a ground for all kinds of amazing things, including this generosity of spirit, as well as, even financial and other. And I think there's one small thing missing from your talk, and maybe you said it, but I'm afraid that I did fall asleep, not because your talk wasn't exciting, but because I was kind of exhausted. But the one thing I thought of was the renunciation part of generosity. And I have experienced it in my life that when I when I turn into a little bit of a renunciate, then it just overwhelms me how much benefit I get from that. It's almost crazy. Like big checks come in the mail and people give things to me and like all kinds of great things happen. And it's just so funny that it makes you really believe in the universe and the goodness of the universe, because how else would that all happen? How else would it be that I renunciate and give away a lot of money and things and it all comes back like tenfold? How could that be? I'm not even exaggerating. And I'm a scientist, so I'm not, it's not like this hippie woohoo thing. It's like a real thing. So anyway, I'll end with that, but.
Well, I'm glad you brought up renunciation, because, and I wish I had brought it up. I did so indirectly because I did talk about letting go and how letting go is related. And letting go is, and renunciation are different ways of looking at the same phenomenon.
Yep,
So, but
it's
yeah,
true.
thanks so much.
It's a big, it's also contentment, like being content, you're way more likely to
Right.
give up, give your neighbor that thing that, you know, you don't need or that, or, you know, that you need and, but want to be generous. You know, it's more about being generous and feeling that, I'll say one more thing, just that connection. It's a connection to everybody that
Yeah.
feels so much stronger than the need to have a thing.
Good. And something else you brought up is metta. And I did have mentioned a number of times how gratitude helps fuel my metta practice. Metta is a form of generosity. We're, you know, sending out these good wishes, these radiant good wishes, this radiant friendliness. To specific people and to the world in general. That is a generosity. So the generosity, I find that when I'm doing metta and it's strong, there's this generosity as it flows out, and then there's an energizing factor coming back to me. So it's again, it's generosity and gratitude and metta can get into this sort of cycle, sort of like a feedback loop, and can become very strong and extremely,
It's blissful. You get into like a
yes,
blissful state.
very
I never
blissful
knew,
state.
Bill, you had this side of you that you were so into metta and so and knew so much about it and generosity. It's really something we have in common.
It's been an important practice for me, and I've talked about metta and the Brahma Viharas on two other occasions in Sangha, and I'm sure I'll do it again. Any excuse that comes along, I will take it.
I'll say one small thing before Zoe goes, and that is just that Rick Hansen is a person who turned me on to metta when I was in a big bind at one point. And I might have mentioned this before, and that I put up a fuss. I said, oh, there's no way I'm going to sit there and wish myself well. That's really lame. Who does that? You know, I'm not going to do that. And if it had been anyone else but Rick, I would not have ever started doing metta. And it turned out it changed my life in hugely profound ways that, like, unbelievable, powerful. Powerful. Careful what you wish for, kind of practice.
Right. Philip once told me that I should be practicing metta, and at that point, the way metta was being taught had no resonance for me at all. I just was, and so I was just like, "Oh, come on, please!"
I know.
And I finally went on a metta retreat and experimented and found a way of doing metta that really worked for me. So
Yeah.
yeah, metta is really an important part of my practice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. So, Zoe.
I was trying to think of when you were talking about, which I love this talk, by the way,
Thank you.
where generosity shows up for me in my life. And I think that when you're in like a service type of work, the most that you can do with people is to just be present with them. And the generosity is not only about listening, but responding in a way that people need the most. And that's when I find myself to be the most generous in my life, I find my ability to do that. And when I do that well, I feel a certain sense of gratitude, I guess, that I'm doing what I'm meant to be doing in that setting and in work. Other areas of life, you know, letting go of things is still a work in practice. I'm making gains in that area, but I do think that sometimes
your generous spirit can show up in those unexpected ways. It may not be about material things, but it may be about the way you show up with certain, with people in certain situations that really is helpful for people in moments when they need it the most. And that we shouldn't underestimate the power of that, even if we're struggling with some of our own personal greed on, at certain times. The moments that we show up are so powerful, I think, and can be powerful for people when we're just, you know, able to be present and non-judgmental and just giving and patient and all the things that people need us to be in that moment. And that's for me what sometimes generosity is all about.
I'm really glad you brought that up. That is very true. You know, I touched on a little bit about presence and about being a good listener. Barbara and I went to a workshop yesterday, and it was taught by Roy Raymer, who has spoken here at Burning Saga a couple of times. He is the executive director of the organization that until recently was called the Zen Hospice Project. They have a different name now, but they essentially do the same thing. And we have a very good friend, several good friends who volunteer with them or have done so in the past. And what they do essentially is simply go there and be present for people who are in the last weeks or days or even hours of their lives. And, you know, they help out. They're there. They help the family and so on. There's a lot that they do. But the most powerful thing they do, the biggest contribution, is simply to be present for people in their last hours. So, yeah, this is a sort of an extreme aspect of service, but I think that's true of any service giver. And, of course, the generosity is, there's a danger in being a caregiver. Philip has talked about this. It's very easy to have compassion overload, which is why the Brahmavihara practices, particularly the practice of equanimity, is so important. But I think also cultivating the generosity is something that helps avoid that burnout. So, thanks. Vita, you had your hand up and you changed your mind. You're muted, so.
Yeah, you can hear me. I changed my mind. First of all, Patty, later, I really would like you to repeat what your phrase is. So, I changed my mind because I'm not sure it was appropriate. But talking about dana and generosity. So when we had the little, so I don't have a lot of resources. I don't want to say it that way. I have a limited income, limited financial resources. I got a lot of other. Mm-hmm. And so when there was a box in the back of the room, I could put whatever and I felt I could comfortably afford, which is what we're supposed to do with dana. What are you comfortably giving? Mm-hmm. A little bit of a stretch, but whatever. And then came Zoom. And then came sending in an amount. And I have to tell you how challenging. So, you know, we talk about generosity. And it was very challenging for me. In my heart, I felt generous. But the number didn't look generous. I don't know if you could understand. You're smiling, Bill, and I appreciate that. But the number didn't feel. Maybe it didn't feel generous to the, it took me, you know, we've been doing this now for a number of years. It has took me a long while before I realized the generosity is what my heart feels. It doesn't make any difference. And knowing our teachers, I'm pretty sure they don't evaluate it either, but that wasn't the point. The point was I had to realize that the issue of generosity is what it feels like to me that I'm doing. I'm either being generous or not generous by my circumstances or my criteria. But it's a heartfelt thing. So I didn't know whether I wanted to share that or not, but I guess I did.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. And there are two things I want to bring up about that. Obviously, generosity, when money is involved, is going to vary a lot from person to person, because the generosity is an inward experience, not a quantifiable outward display. So what amounts to generosity from one person is going to be very different from another person. And I think everybody, you know, we've talked about this a lot in on the board of directors of the Sangha, because we know that, you know, with the box in the back of the room, Donna was fairly easy. The logistics of the Donna that we collect has become more complicated, and it's easier to forget. I have forgotten to give Donna to some of our teachers. And I often wonder, oh, did I give Donna to so-and-so? And I'll go back and look at my PayPal account to see if I have. And sometimes I just forget completely. So, and the other thing I wanted to point out, and I think this, I'm calling you out specifically, is that you're one of the most generous people I know. And not in terms of money, in terms of the time you put into Sangha, the things you've done, like organize our day longs, for instance. You've been an integral part of this Sangha, and it's your generosity that has helped this Sangha stay alive since 1998. So you get this great feeling just even thinking about your generosity.
Thank you. And you bring up an important part, I think. There's something about what you said about generosity as a community. There's somewhere there's a connection between our hearts, our generosity, and our community. And I'm not quite sure what that is. When you come up with that, you could do another talk.
Right. Well, a lot of people have brought up that and expressed it in different ways. And yes, it is. It feels like this web is the only metaphor I can think of that binds us together.
And thank you for your kind words, Bill. You are. Oh. We won't even deal with how much generosity and how much you are able to give him, but we won't go there.
All right. Thanks. Nancy.
First of all, Bill, I just so appreciate the various things you brought into your talk today, even in the Q&A, and the responding has just been really lovely and helpful. You know, as you spoke, I am a professional caregiver, and I look around the room and a number of us are. And so it's the top of the hour. I'm going to be meeting with a client. And I provide the generous act of listening. But then so as you were talking, I was thinking, is that it's a generous form of my contribution to the world that I decided on a long time ago, but it's also my profession. And so I was a little confused about how much of it is generosity. How much of it is my work and profession? But I think I, in my daily life, I really work to be present with people. And so it's all woven together, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. You know?
Yes, and I think there's two parts of you're in a situation that has its complexity. There's two parts. There is a reciprocity. You sit there and you use your experience to help people who pay you money. But there's also, you do more than is necessary for your work. That's where the generosity comes in. You're cultivating a generosity that is more than simply, you know, going through the motions. If you turned off that generosity, you'd probably still do a good job because of your experience, your wisdom.
Oh,
you know, you'd probably be very good at that, but you add more. You bring more to it, and that's the generosity that you've just expressed. So I think you know, there's something very special in what you bring beyond what's expected.
That brings tears to my eyes and warms my heart. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Barbara, since I'll let you come back again, since no one else has raised their hand and we have time.
I just want to add something to what Nancy was talking about, because I think that generosity is really an important practice in service groups and teaching. And I'm in a critique group. And some of my generosity is to be able to say things that be totally present, and yet people might not want to hear about their precious work, and listen to when people talk about my precious work and I don't want to hear it, and to just to cultivate an attitude of giving. And if I have to sit and spend extra time with the work, I will do that just so I can cultivate generosity and feeling that sense. And to me, it's really made a difference in being with a group. I've been in the same group for like 20 years now, and it goes beyond just people critiquing books, you know.
Right.
And so that's, I think, everyone, how you live your right livelihood, that is part of generosity, is part of right livelihood.
Right. And I know that what you do, it goes way beyond the reciprocity of the arrangement that you have with your fellow writers. Because I've seen the work that you put in to your reading, to putting together your critiques.